Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
En Camino with Kit Hogg.
Hello and welcome to another brand new episode of your Saturday morning supplement here on Talk Radio Europe this 27th of June. Yes, you are En Camino with Janie Jewson.
Good morning.
And me, Kit Hogg. On today's show, we say happy birthday Brexit. 10 years on, we ask, did anything good come from Britain's divorce from Europe? And with the 90-day visa restrictions on UK passport holders, we reflect on the downside of maintaining a second home here in Spain. Plus, the muster of hundreds of horses from Doñana that occurred yesterday, La Saca de las Yeguas in El Rocío, getting your legs out for summer, cut-off jeans. How short are your short shorts this year? On the part of the show we call things that grow seaweed, a free source of compost readily available at a beach near you, good for your garden. Sun-dried tomatoes, delicious, but can they be bad for your health? Unlike the bonding comfort of watching football together, which, according to a recent survey conducted by El País, can only be good for us.
En Camino with Kit Hogg.
Now, this is a question I never thought I'd ask you, Janie, but how's your World Cup going?
Well, it's all that's on the BBC, isn't it? So you kind of, I've got the attitude of if you can't beat them, join them, you know. And so I thought I'd have a little look. And actually, Kit, it was rather exciting. I am not a football watcher at all, and I've never played football either. And I did actually ask my son, who happened to be there at the same time, when I said, would you like to come and watch this match with me? He told me what offside meant, and he explained it in a way which I understood. So it was quite an exciting idea to watch this.
That's amazing. I didn't know he was that articulate.
Rude.
No, but to get you to understand the offside.
Oh, I see. It's
really an expression of linguistic competence.
Yes, absolutely.
Can you remember who was playing?
Well, actually, I do. Let me think.
Without looking at your notes.
Ecuador v Germany.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I saw that on YouTube. I saw the highlights of that on YouTube.
And I watched it beginning to end. And I really, really enjoyed it. I couldn't wait to keep, you know, go right to the end. And the thrill of the crowd when Ecuador won was infectious. I mean, the place absolutely erupted at each goal. I really, really, really enjoyed it.
Well, fantastic. Yes, I've been denying myself football, actually, but I...
Why?
Because I don't have a TV with football on it. I saw England play Croatia. But that's the only full match that I've watched. But
why are you doing this to yourself?
Because I don't have a TV with and I'm living in the sticks, it just hasn't. Yeah, so it's a shame. It's a shame. I am listening to the Guardian podcast, so I get it in retrospect.
It's not the same though.
I enjoy it. No, of course it's not the same. But there's plenty to go. I mean, it goes on. It goes on for 6 weeks.
Does it? Oh, God. I was going to ask. Actually, no. I mean, I haven't got a clue who's where or who's
doing
what.
The thing with the World Cup is that by the end of it, you think back and you think, God, was that this tournament? It feels like months ago.
Well, it was 10 years ago that... Was it 10 years or 9 years ago that Spain actually won?
No, it would have been... I can't remember. Spain were very good in the early part of this millennium.
But I did... I remember coming back from England after a little break away there. Maybe it was 2012. I don't know. Whatever year it was.
2012, they won something. So these are Europeans every 4 years and the World Cup every 4 years, and they go interspersed. So there's a big tournament every 2 summers.
Okay. I see. Okay, I remember coming back and watching people, you know, jumping up and down on roundabouts. shouts and there were things blasting all over the place. And that night, I hadn't actually seen anybody for a while, and I hadn't connected with them, and I had started doing a drive around to get a bit of a feel of what everything was like, and managed to ram another car and smash my radiator.
Oh, well, there's a memory for you. Nerea Bastera, writing in El País, says that getting together to watch football, even though it might seem insignificant, helps to maintain networks, those small repeated encounters, those relationships. And it is very important because these routines have a significant impact on our health.
Mm.
I suppose it's about sharing and getting excited together. And
yeah, doing and something together and all feeling elated
like
or miserable.
Sitting on the sofa.
Yeah.
Professor at the Sports Science Faculty at the University of Murcia, Ernesto de la Cruz, writes, "The match lasts 90 minutes, but the connection can last much longer because the entire World Cup functions as a shared social agenda.
Mm.
It gives us a date, a common narrative. Conversation, sometimes animated, develops punditry between people who may never have spoken to each other before, moments of shared experience." The moments of shared experience watching football that I remember most clearly is a particular cafe in Morocco run by a guy called Hamid. It was when we had a hotel in Chef Shalon. And it wasn't a World Cup. They were big European club games. But everybody knew they were about to happen, and most people were supporting Real Madrid or Barcelona. So the Spanish teams got packed audiences. The audience would pack into this kind of run-down cafe with paint peeling off concrete walls. Hamid's offsider, Abdul, would put on his purple jacket. You'd be shown to a chair. There was rows of wooden chairs, quite a small TV, and you could just about see it through the tobacco smoke. But people were so into it. It was the sweetest thing. So that's my memory of echoing what Nerea Bastera says, that getting together to watch football is a healthy thing.
But what happens when they lose?
And who loses?
Well, if a team loses, they've all gone to support it, and don't they come out all miserable and angry?
Well, no, then you can console each other and debrief together, which is important.
Yeah.
It seems like weeks ago now that Argentina opened their defence of the title in a match against Algeria. The result was 3-0, a Lionel Messi hat-trick in Kansas City. With a World Cup fever just a little more acute than Janie's, three Argentinian fans had cycled, get this, 11,000 miles to be there. Cycled.
Good Lord.
From Argentina to Kansas. Vicente Conculini, Miguel Cilio and Yamandu Martinez left their hometown last August to get there, carrying all their gear on bicycles. And Vicente Conculini told ABC News that before their journey, they'd never heard of Kansas City. And on their arrival there, Vicente actually went on air. He was interviewed on a local radio station to tell us that on a scale of 1 to 10, his love for Argentinian football is at 11, which I would suggest is similar to a lot of Argentinian fans.
But did he do it because he couldn't afford to fly or catch bus or something?
I think probably they spent more money during that 11 months or however long it took them to get to. No, it was an expedition.
Okay.
And it was also a demonstration of their passionate devotion to Argentinian football. The mayor of Kansas welcomed them gracefully with a gift of three tickets to the match.
Oh, lucky them.
Where Lionel Messi scores three goals. So their cup of joy overfloweth. Anyway, that's enough of football.
Yeah.
With summer well and truly here, I was going to say with a vengeance, but restrain myself, you will by now have got your legs out. I guess I'm speaking particularly to blokes here, because women tend to have their legs out a lot more than blokes, because you wear skirts, don't you?
We do, yes.
And
yes,
dresses.
We wear dresses, yeah.
Which we only sometimes wear. But you know what I mean, that first exposure some weeks back in spring when your legs look like white things dangling out of your shorts, reminiscent of leeks or some other kind of winter vegetable.
Earbuds.
Oh. That's bad. That also denotes really spindly legs.
Yes, spindly legs.
Okay, earbud legs. Yes. I like that. I've been given the early season remedy. I've given this early season remedy for earbud legs,
yes,
or winter vegetable legs before. It's for getting some colour into your newly exposed legs. Okay, so picture this. You're having an Andaluz breakfast of tostada and aceite. Aceite. Oil.
Oh, no, I know what you're going to say.
In a venta.
Yeah.
And you surreptitiously, without anybody looking.
Because only you do that.
You tip a measure of olive oil into the palm of your hand and then rub them sensuously on your shins, calves and thighs.
That's to moisturise, though. It's not to get a suntan.
Oh, it cooks them very nicely. Believe me. Now, of course you get a suntan if you put oil on your skin.
All right, so then you've got to lie out in it.
Well, no, you're just sitting there eating the rest of your tostada. And that kind of takes that horrible white flaky sheen off your legs.
Shh, people don't want to know that.
And anyway, and that brings me to the shorts one wears in summer, because suddenly, like jumpers and jackets, the idea of long trousers becomes untenable. The jeans you've been in all winter, they wrap themselves around you in their sort of restrictive, clammy denim. So stash them in your wardrobe till October. So what do you do now? Well, here's what I did this week with an ill-fitting, tight pair of jeans with a Gregorio Armani label on.
So no.
I think they were real.
I didn't know you had clothes like that.
Well, they came from a second-hand shop.
Oh.
But they were ill-fitting, okay, and the leg was too short anyway, and the subject of ridicule. So I cut them off.
You got the scissors out, right.
I got the scissors out, yes. Do you know what I did? I actually put them on to measure where I was going to cut them.
Oh, very, very forward-thinking of you.
And managed to jab the scissors into the material without jabbing my leg.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pertinent procedure because apart from getting the new legs the same length, you have to ask yourself, how short do I want my shorts?
But hang on, did you do the whole process round?
No, I just made the mark.
You just made the mark.
Mark on both legs,
yeah,
which turned out más o menos igual.
They turned out to be equal?
Yes, approximately.
Yeah.
They start fraying, so, you know, there's a bit of give and take. Anyway, how short? That's the decision you have to make. How short am I going to cut my shorts this summer?
I don't know, Kit. It's up to you. I mean, you've got quite good legs.
I would say, yes.
You have, and they're quite long. I think for you, I would go just above the knee, or possibly about maybe 4 inches above the knee.
So two governing factors here. One, crucially, are you a woman or a man?
Well, we're talking about you, so obviously I think
I'm trying to generalise it.
Okay. Oh, generally. Okay, I see.
And two, as you've already alluded to, Jenny, what shape are your legs?
Oh.
So women, I would say, can get away with and can look good in short shorts.
Okay.
So like short shorts.
Yes.
But men in hot pants?
Oh, absolutely not.
No.
No.
It's not a good look.
And I do recall putting on a pair of shorts in your house when your wife was there, Penny, and I put them on. I sort of turned around, she just went, "No, Janie."
Why? They were too short?
Just my legs is the problem. I think some people do have legs they really want to. Women have legs they'd really like to show off. Some women do have legs that could be shown off, but don't want to because they're not very happy with them. And I'm one of those. So I wouldn't wear short shorts.
No. Okay. So I reckon there's three options for short length.
Mm.
You've got mid-thigh and for blokes, please don't go any higher.
Yes.
For women, you've got short shorts.
Yeah.
But for men, I reckon there are three options. There's mid-thigh, there's just above the knee, or there's pedal pushers. Pedal pushers are like around the calf, just around the calf. They're
Calf mast. They don't quite make it down the bottom. They look like they shouldn't be like that.
Very good.
Yeah.
Calf
okay.
mask.
Okay. Right. So what did you do? What lengths were yours?
Above the knee, about 4 inches above the knee, as indeed you've intimated, Janie. So I'm not sure how you got that, but
okay. So and you're happy?
I wouldn't have them any shorter.
Okay. All right. Well, I've got a nice sound of summer here, Kitley. Can you tell me what you think this is?
Is someone grating a carrot very fast?
Sounds like it, doesn't it? Or, yeah, a toy train.
It could be a toy train, yeah. Something mechanical that's slightly out of control.
Yeah, well, it was actually a dog. Oh, panting.
Right, okay.
Panting, appropriate, ha-ha.
Sound of summer.
Yep, panting.
Right.
Panting dog, panting trousers.
She was all right,
shorts.
Yeah.
She was fine, yeah. It's just what they do, isn't it? They get super, super hot.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
you get them home and they just lie there.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's kind of stressy as a dog owner to hear your dog panting like that. Unless you know they're close to water. So anyway, tell us, talking of things summer, tell us about the fin de colegio, because you were at the end of your grandchild's school term.
That's right. Yes. A 9-year-old and a 6-year-old. We went up to Casares Pueblo, which is the school that they go to. They go into the school in Casares. I went with my daughter-in-law, and it was absolute chaos. It doesn't actually happen in the school. It happens in this sort of public area outside the Anton Miento office, below the main Pueblo, but it's still incredibly high. So there are lowish-looking walls, and which children could, you know, easily fall off, leap over. But there was nobody there in the way of security. Nothing secure. There was no, like you'd have in England, a Red Cross or a sign of, you know, here's the first aid box or anything like that. And so it was just absolute mayhem. 20 classes of children. There are about 400 kids in this school, so parents and grandparents and, you know, all brothers and sisters were all there as well, so literally hundreds of people. They're tearing all over the place, these kids. They were having a great time, and there was some play equipment there too. Anyway, we got through it. I mean, it was utterly deafening as well, you know, and food being cooked, lots of smells of meat and beer and, you know, a few fags going on and vapes and all this sort of thing secretly. Trying to keep an eye on your own children or the ones you're, you know, looking after is quite hard because they just want to go off and disappear in the melee.
Was there a format or was it just a complete melee? Was there like an actuación, a play or...?
It's not like when my kids were little and they'd do this charming play, you know, and they'd all have a little role. No, it's like this big stage, you know, and beyond that, you know, is the vista down to Gibraltar across the valley. And then the big stage and lots of sort of lights, massive speakers, so, you know, nobody can talk to one another when it's all happening. And these children just pile onto the stage and they do a dance to a chosen piece of music, which is, you know, pop.
Okay, right. So no one's singing or making music. They're actually dancing.
They're all dancing. And so they start from the tots to the teenagers. And there's 20 of them. Hmm. So it's quite grueling.
There's 20 different actuations.
Absolutely.
20 different... Oh, God.
Yes. Right, and by the end of it, you know, trying to keep an eye on the kids, we were ready to go before we got to the teenage level. And, you know, my daughter-in-law found the younger child and I was duted with finding the other one. So the 9-year-old, I couldn't find him anywhere. And then to my great alarm, I see this mature lady walking along with him and a pack of ice to his eye. Oh, my God. He had played on a piece of play equipment which had not been fixed properly to the ground and wasn't last year either. A steel rod literally whacked him in the face. So he had this huge bruise, luckily underneath his eye, it didn't go in it, and blood coming out of his nose and ice against his face. I mean, poor love, he was traumatised. but you couldn't actually properly deal with it there because there was so much noise. You know, and these were great lumps of ice from the bar,
right.
You know, wrapped in a piece of napkin.
But he did have an ice pack.
Of sorts, yes. Anyway, we managed to get away eventually, and my daughter-in-law has made a denuncia, and I think that's quite right.
Okay. And it's a long summer break for young parents, isn't it?
It sure is.
Oh, so you think mid to late June, well, it's the solstice really, the first week of September.
Yeah, and they went straight off to the
long time.
UK's heatwave.
Did they? Okay. Yes, well, good for them.
Yes.
And now for something completely different, writing in last Saturday's Times, Tom McTague says, it's hard to avoid becoming cynical following British politics of late. For 10 years now, Westminster has been in a state of near constant upheaval, quite comfortably the worst period of governments in Britain's modern democratic history. Whatever else might be said about Brexit, the vote to leave a decade ago has exposed a political class that appears unable to govern, sitting atop a state no longer fit for purpose. We voted to take back control, but have discovered that our leaders can't handle it. Unsurprisingly, polling currently shows a comfortable majority believe the decision to leave was a mistake. A New Statesman focus group in Makerfield, where they've just had that by-election earlier this month, indicates that voters took for granted that Brexit wasn't working and blamed politicians for it, but didn't much like the idea of reopening the debate because there were more important things to worry about. Brexit has left us poorer, it's delivered even higher levels of immigration, and paradoxically for expatriates, less freedom of movement. What do you have to say, Janie?
What do I have to say? Well, I remember that actual day 10 years ago. My son was getting married. You were there. Many people were there in the UK from different countries. Germany, Poland, France, Spain. All sorts of people had turned up and the vote was announced on their wedding day, and there was just this feeling of how can that have happened? And of course, we being Spanish residents, we couldn't vote at that time on the referendum.
An absolute miscarriage of justice that was.
And really quite horrified that this had happened at all. And quite rightly so. I think it's been absolute disaster. It was like sort of they untethered themselves from the dock of Europe and just floated off into the sort of realms of nowhere with no support at all.
Yes. Now, there's a recent book being published, so if you've got the appetite for a long summer read, I would just like to mention this, that on the 10th anniversary of the referendum, it's a publication of a 622-page book with 37 chapters by 40 different authors, including many of the country's top political advisors, journalists, pollsters and academics. And it suggests very strongly that the British are not quite done with discussing Brexit, and that it is just as it should be it's arguably the most consequential foreign policy decision the UK has taken since the Second World War. And while the debate over Brexit may have receded, at least for now, its profound impact on virtually every aspect of the UK economy, society and political system has certainly not. Now, the book is called The Brexit Effect, and it's edited by Sir Anthony Seldon. And one of its many merits is this timely and comprehensive look at both the origins and impact of Brexit is that it helps explain to puzzled outsiders why the British a decade ago chose to commit what many looked like economic suicide and political isolation. Two of the most important factors were the devastating impact of the 2008-09 financial crisis, which hit Britain harder than any other major economy and fostered inequality and resentment of already unpopular elites, and the backlash against rising levels of immigration inflamed by the Syrian refugee crisis. that was blamed on the EU's open borders. I mean, they were the two factors that the leavers played very heavily on. It was about taking back control. But, yes.
And losing it in the process.
Yes, I think that's probably what happened.
Yeah. So, I mean, and for people here who, you know, bought a second home, for example, in Spain or anywhere in Europe who are from the UK, they can't maintain them. They have to flipping well sell the damn things and go back, or decide before Brexit actually happened they were going to stay here permanently. There was no choice.
Well, you can't stay here permanently unless you've got a TIE card, as we well know, because we've been covering this story for a couple of weeks
years.
Now. Well, it's been a factor, hasn't
it? Yeah.
I do have a story about second homes, but we've run out of time for this topic now. So maybe we'll hear that next week.
Yeah.
We're going to have a break now, and then we're going to go to a little village in Huelva province called El Rocío, and say hello to some horses.
En Camino with Kit Hogg.
2 years ago to the day, we spent the night in El Rocío. El Rocío is famous for Andalusia's Great Romería, a pilgrimage of some 500,000 rocieros who gather at Pentecost yearly, 7 weeks after Easter, to worship the Mother of God in her incarnation of the Virgin of the Dew. Rocío means dew. There was precious little of it about as the mercury levelled at 42 degrees on consecutive days that day in late June. We'd missed the pilgrimage by some weeks before, but were there for something else. Something called La Saca de las Yeguas. I'll explain las yeguas in a moment, except to say that the crowd it drew, not quite the 500,000 who had come to see the Virgin of the Dew, but it was populous enough to have occupied all the hotels, hostels and Airbnbs in the Pueblo. So we stayed in a favela of prefab bungalow cabins on the edge of town, on the edge of town campsite. I felt a bit like a £10 POM in a 1960s Australian internment accommodation, where bag-eyed families from Farringdon stare glazed over breakfast at a suffocating sleep after a suffocating sleepless night of century heat, and think, though no one can bear to articulate it, what are we doing here? What have we done? But apart from big shady groves of eucalyptus, there was nothing in El Rocío itself to rekindle Australian memories. Though, actually, there was. There were verandas giving lovely wide shade to the street frontage of low white houses, classically proportioned in southern style, black rejas over windows punctuating white walls. Southern, yes, but there was also a western feel here too. There were as many horses as cars on the soft, straight streets. The Mexican vibe becomes positively film set as you realise why the streets are soft. You're on sand. The sand of Doñana and its pine forest floor. There is no tarmac in El Rocío. No road signs, no road markings, no rights of way. The traffic on foot, hoof or wheel bimbles about in mutual tolerance. The ample streets become so wide you can just stop anywhere. El Rocío, the easiest place to park in Spain. And then the streets get wider still, opening into Maidan-sized expanses of lifting, drifting dust and distant mule-drawn carts. For the want of a mosque, you could be in North Africa. Except that El Rocío is surprisingly clean. No chucked paper, glass or plastic. And where's all the horse poo? There are no motorbikes or scooters. And anyway, the mosques disappeared with the Moors. The mosques is a porcelain white church, La Ermita del Rocío, adorning the sands of a plaza so ample as to be the fringe of a small desert, bordering an oasis of glassy wetland, shimmering wading birds, because La Ermita shines like a mirage in this lake. an immaculate conch-shell portico arches over the main door, as though heralding the entrance to a translucent cave. La Ermita apart, suggestions of Australia, Mexico and Morocco abide in my first impressions of El Rocío. However, this sense of the foreign is misplaced. The potency of this place is 100%, 100% Andalus. So essentially unadulterated, it feels exotic. I think I can say that having lived in the province of Malaga for 25 years, until I experienced El Rocío, I had never encountered the untouched soul of Andalusia. The undiluted purity of El Sur is palpable here, uncontaminated by Burger Kings, golf courses, urbanisations and packaged tourists that so anaesthetise the costas. El Rocío, its virgin, its horses, its music, its alegría. Why, even Cruz Campo tastes good here. El Rocío exudes the authenticity of a culture so robustly indigenous that, by paradox, it feels something other. By 9:30 in the evening, the bludgeoning heat had dropped to 35 degrees. We left the 10-pound Pom cabin and wallowed lightly along boulevards of sand into town, where an evening paseo was taking place. Saddled or horse-drawn, it was an equine affair. Extended families trundled by in carretas, open carriages, one that was drawn by five mules. The carretas varied in style, some old school with spoked wheels, others low profile, chrome verging on bling chariots. Groups of young, made gracious by their steeds and broad-brimmed hats, ambled the twilight, overtaken by a beautiful girl, her stallion in full canter, her hair, its mane. There were horses at the bar, patiently stood, their owners mounted, chatting and quaffing happily. Paca de Lucia pumped through a PA, live music too, as coplers ran out of the Hermanidad pavilions. It was after midnight by the time we ate. Croquetas, easy on the digestion, not that anyone appeared to be thinking of sleeping. As though the more intense heat of the afternoon, the more beautiful the release of evening and its gradual soothing darkness. Besides, there was anticipation in the air, because tomorrow these sandy avenues would fill with wild horses for the annual Saca de las Yeguas. That morning of the 26th of June, we checked out of our favela campground to join the thousands lining the wide esplanades of El Rocío, whose horsemen and women, proud and unhurried, strutted the sand, mounted in elegant slouch, hips rolling in the saddle, clean, loose white shirts, campero pinstripes, low-heeled riding boots in mosaics of tooled leather, long palos resting on their shoulders like lances. These are the yeguaziros, behind which, in a tsunami of mane, tail, and brown hide, come some 1,000 wild horses jostling and weaving, unknowingly receiving the blessing of La Salve as they pass the Santuario de la Virgen del Rocío. This recipe for equine chaos never turns into chaos. The yeguaziros walk the mares and foals with unhurried tranquility. No voices are raised, apart from the unnecessary antics of Guardia Civil on quads. The procession is virtually silent. The crowd deepening behind protective barriers, waving mobiles and long-lens cameras, are wrapped in reverence. As the potrito foals try to keep pace with their mothers, where, I wonder, are the stallions? Wandering the baked, drought, cracked flats of Doñana, looking for their wives and children, no doubt, will spare a thought for these machos separated from their families in defiance of danger by skilled ganaderos of the Asociación Nacional de Criadores de Ganado Marismo. They're only in temporary absence. The mares will return. The Stallions might even enjoy the break for the weekend, get together for a few beers. On a more serious and barely credulous note, my friend Victorine, with whom I was in El Rocío, told me that these same wild horses of Doñana, La Raza Marismeña, are ancestors of the Mustang. Victorine is an authority on horses. In spite of this, I told her she was deluded, in a nice way, and that the Mustang was the original indigenous wild equine of North America, as American as the Great Plains and the Rocky Mountains. But no, it turns out that the last native North American horse died 11,400 years ago in the Pleistocene era. For nearly 11 millennia, there were no horses in America until Hernán Cortés arrived in 1519 with a boatload of them. Blindfolded to prevent panic, carefully raised from below deck by hoists attached to slings around the horses' bodies, they were lowered into the water to swim ashore, led by men in rowboats. What a way to arrive in a new world. And where did Hernán Cortés' horses come from? From here, of course, in Doñana. The breed, La Raza Marismeña, is the source of the modern horse in the New World. And that includes the wild variant, the icon of the West, the Mustang. Spain not only gave sheep to Australia, but America its horses.
Hello. Oh, Kit. Do you have any times when you've actually something really awful's happened, but actually you find you can laugh about it afterwards?
Blimey. Yes. I can safely say yes, although nothing comes immediately to mind.
Okay.
I haven't prepared an example of that, Jenny. You've put me completely on the hop.
Oh, I love to do that because you
hopping
do it
around.
With, you do it with me so often. Yeah. Anyway.
Oh, well, who knows?
Anyway, I was in a shop the other day with somebody who I know quite well, and we were looking at some of the things for sale. They were quite interesting. It was kind of like a random sort of sporty type of shop. And they had on the counter, they had these things called hacky sacks. Do you remember hacky sacks?
I do remember hacky sacks, yes.
They're like small balls, usually leather or some other material.
Like they're a tiny bag, aren't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, like a bag, sort of that sewn up with beads.
Just about in the palm of your hand.
That's right, with sort of beads inside them. And the idea is you play hacky sack. So you kind of, you throw them up in the air and then you, with a group of people or sometimes just two, try and keep it off the ground by bouncing it from one to the other. Don't have a bounce, but you sort of hit them with different parts of your body to keep it up.
Keepy uppy.
That's right.
Yeah, but you're not, I mean, basically with the same rules as football, you can't hold on to it or yeah. use your hand.
Right.
You can use your shoulder, can't you?
You can use your shoulder, you can use your legs,
you can
back kick them.
Yes.
You know, it's actually quite a fun game.
Yeah.
If you're feeling a bit dexterous still, you know, mobile. Anyway, I was in the shop.
You saw some hacky sacks. Did you say you saw some or not?
Yes, this was a while ago, though. Not so long ago, sorry, because the story is actually quite old, but I'm not supposed to tell you that. Anyway, it was very funny. I was facing this person, and they picked up the hacky sack and threw it up in the air, and it dropped on the floor. And both of us, at exactly the same time, bent down to pick it up. We cracked heads so hard, the two of us almost bit through our tongues. And we both just stood up, just like sort of absolutely, oh, my God, and just turned and walked out of the shop.
Kind of spitting blood.
Yes. It was just, I mean, look, it was very, very painful, but it did make me laugh. Anyway.
Right. So banged heads going for the same hacky sack. Okay, yeah.
Another thing, that this did happen recently. Every year, okay, I put up a mosquito screen to my front door so that I can leave it open, I can keep the air flowing through, and in the summer, you know, I need that because my place does not get good flow of air through because it's kind of dug down into the hill a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, there I am. I'm so happy I've put it up. And I think, okay, I'm going to leave the front door open tonight. And I've got a nice protection there. And so I sat and watched telly for a bit inside. And then just as I was about to go to bed, I thought, okay, I'm going to leave the door open. And I looked up. And on the other side of this screen was an enormous spider.
Mm-hmm.
And I just saw the gap underneath the bottom of the mosquito screen, and I thought, no, I'm not leaving it open. So I shut the door, and I whacked it. I'd whacked it so it sort of flew away from the mosquito screen, okay?
Well, right. The spider flew away.
Yes, yes, I flew away, but I decided to shut the door for the night.
Okay, was it a flying spider, Janie?
No. It was just quite a big one that made actually a clunking sound when it hit the water bottle on the other side, so it was quite sizable,
uh-huh.
Right? So the next day, I'm in the kitchen, and I'm looking around, and just to my right, I see this very same spider on one of the pots with my wooden spoons in it. I tell you what, I have never moved so fast. These spiders move at great speed, right? But I managed to catch it and got rid of it. But now I have all my windows and doors shut.
You didn't kill it then?
I didn't kill it. No, good. No, I don't kill these things.
I'm glad. I am a fan of spiders. I like spiders.
Yeah.
They get a tough rap.
Yeah.
The Virago posts which is one of those email feeds that I get that just sort of arrive in my email box. Mm. But a nice story, this. Washington State, Northwest USA, a moose was on the highway. Yeah, imagine this. Slamming into cars, trying to protect what looked like his or her calf, which was motionless on the road until people, and then people realized that he was protecting this thing on the road, and queues of traffic built up. The moose wasn't letting anyone pass, and at first no one realized what he was guarding. So there's this traffic jam, yeah, and but in actual fact, the small animal that this moose was standing over protectively wasn't a moose calf at all. It was a bear cub.
Oh, my goodness.
Isn't that amazing? So the wildlife experts arrived, the wildlife police or whatever, and they managed to get the moose back to the roadside and off the road, and were able to rescue the cub who'd been hit by a previously passing car, and assuredly saved by the heroic moose.
You quite often see these videos on phones, on Instagram and stuff, of other animals of different species, you know, like a dog trying to get a duck out of the water or
yeah,
something like that. They help each other. Isn't that nice?
It's really good story time, yeah.
Yeah.
It's time for this.
On the land, but it is fed and watered by God's Almighty.
Yes, welcome to the part of the show we call Things That Grow. And on Things That Grow today, we've got tomatoes and seaweed. Janie, tomatoes. We're going to hear about sun-dried tomatoes.
Oh, I've got a glut of them in my garden, these lovely tomatoes are big and bulbous and just beautiful, and too many for me to eat. And I love sun-dried tomatoes in olive oil. You buy them in jars from the supermarket. Have you had them?
I love them, yes.
Aren't
but I have
gorgeous?
Had trouble finding them recently.
Have you?
So maybe making your own sun-dried tomatoes, if you've got a glut of them, is the way to go.
Absolutely.
Do you do that?
Well, I made some last year and they were very, very delicious. So I thought and I only did a jar or two. So I'm doing them in more quantity this year. It takes a while to dry them. You cut them in half. You scoop out the seeds from the centre. Basically, you put them onto a tray, you put them into full sun. You protect them with a mesh screen on top. So the insects don't get them. And you probably have to keep doing this for about two or three days in these kinds of temperatures, around about 30, 32, that sort of temperature.
So and do you say you scoop out the seeds?
Well,
why do you do that?
I only just realised this, you see. What's actually happened, I'm going to go backwards here a bit, because I told you this was what I was doing, and you said, have you done this before? And I said, yes. But there was something I thought that was a bit odd about the way I was doing it, so I decided to research it. And I am very glad I did, Kit. I could have died.
Perish the thought.
Absolutely. Because poorly or not properly canned things, you know, foods and things that have not been preserved properly can carry or develop a bacterium which is found naturally in the soil and dust. But it is highly harmful to humans because it produces a nerve poison which blocks nerve function and can lead to severe muscle paralysis, difficulty breathing, and even death if left untreated. And this is called Clostridium botulinum.
Sort of botulosis.
Botulism.
Botulism. Kit. So what?
Yes.
How can you get botulism from a sun-dried tomato?
Well, actually, what happens is because you actually put the sun-dried tomato, which if it's not properly dried, or you add, you know, it's not completely dry, or you add fresh herbs to it, and then you enclose it in this olive oil in a jar, it is the ideal lack of oxygen environment for this bacteria to grow. Unless you put it straight in the fridge, but you should never put any damp herbs or anything, or onions or a garlic, for example, in it, fresh garlic or anything like that, because that is when this can start to develop. And, of course, I had done this. I had done this. I had made two or three jars of these tomatoes, dunked them in the oil. There were some, actually not fresh herbs, thankfully, but they were oregano and stuffed out of a pot. And I was chomping away at them, rather enjoying them. I think I might even have fed some to you when you came round for lunch the other day. You're still alive, though.
Yes, not botulistic at all.
No, and I had not put the other ones in the fridge. And I realised this is actually so dangerous. My son was there when I was telling him about this, and all the warnings on the internet were saying, go to emergencies immediately. Go to the poison, call the poison emergency service, tell them what you've done, and you could, you know, you will have to have an antitoxin drip put in you and keep an eye on yourself and anybody else who's eaten these. I mean, basically, we went into full alarm mode. I mean, it could still happen. You know, it takes 72 hours minimum.
Right. It's one of the symptoms of incessant raving, I'm wondering.
Anyway, the fact is you can actually store them.
Right.
You can do these.
All of which is telling you you shouldn't try and dry your own tomatoes.
Well,
you
actually
should go to the shop and buy them.
No, I have actually just picked a whole load. I'm going to start again. I'm going to do them properly. And you have to do it in a certain way. I'm not going to tell you, because if I tell you and you get it wrong, you might sue me.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, and we are talking on the radio when some people might be listening. And that's it for sun-dried tomatoes this week. Let's just talk briefly about crocodiles. When a group of tourists visited a Florida crocodile farm, the owner made a bold suggestion. He said, I'll give $1 million to whoever jumps in, swims to shore, and survives. And while no one else moved, one man is suddenly in the water, swimming for his life, chased by crocodiles. Having got to the shore, he was showered with praise from everyone present, including his wife, including the owner, who announced, a brave winner has just been born. And he paid the brave winner $1 million that
wow.
he said he would. And the happy couple returned to their hotel. The news had spread through the locality. On arrival, the hotel manager congratulated them and said to the man, hey, that was off the scale valiant that you jumped in. And the man said, I didn't jump. Someone pushed me. His wife was smiling. all goes to show that behind every successful man is a strong woman.
That is terrible. I know. We're going to have to talk about seaweed next week, Kit.
We will talk about seaweed next week. I'm going to leave you with a quote from the 18th century Empress of Russia talking about strong women, Catherine the Great, who remarked, "I shall be an autocrat. That's my trade. The good Lord shall forgive me. That's his." And that's all for now. We'll see you next week. From Janie and myself.
And bye-bye.
Bye-bye and happy weekend.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this program, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels, and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.